So thanks. Thanks a lot. The main ideas that I'd like to talk about today are related to soil mineral organic complexes, and that these mineral organic complexes form during parallel or coupled inorganic and organic weathering reactions. These MOCs, or mineral organic complexes, are very heterogeneous, and they exist along a continuum in composition related to pedogenic status. And I'll show some examples of that. Their surface reactivity is distinct from the bulk chemistry of the materials. The organic tends to mask inorganic, and inorganic masks organic, depending upon the stage of pedogenesis, at least in the soils that I'll be talking about today. They exhibit a labile structure that can change. Both surface reactivity and bulk structure can change, with changes driven by soil biogeochemical dynamics. And microbial response to environmental perturbations are rapid, which changes not only the reactivity of the surfaces on these mineral organic complexes, but also the bulk chemistry over short event timescales. So when we talk about the superposition of weathering reactions, we can think of one inorganic weathering reaction, which relates to the talk Bob Graham gave earlier this morning, where in this case I'm showing a reaction where biotite's weathering all the way to kaolinite and goethite, not to the vermiculite. But here's, in fact, a similar structure to what Bob showed earlier. The weathering of these biotite books is observed, for example, in saprolites and in ultisol in North Carolina, where you get these biotites coated with kaolin minerals and goethite that create a much higher specific surface area of these clay minerals on the surfaces of the primary biotite books. This is superimposed, for example, with organic weathering reactions or humification processes, where plant-derived biomolecules, proteins, polysaccharides, lipids, lignin, undergo transformation, fragmentation, coagulation, condensation reactions to form humic-type molecules and biomolecular fragments and their aggregates. And so these two are coupled, obviously, with each other. One example is microbial catalysis and redox chemistry, where reduced carbon is used as a carbon source for microbial growth. And some of the mineral structures, particularly secondary mineral structures like manganese oxides and iron three oxides, can be used as electron acceptors in respiration. And in this milieu of weathering of both the humic, the organic material and the inorganic material, we form sort of this complex array of heteroaggregates that comprise both the organic and inorganic components and nanoparticles. So this is sort of the context for what I'm going to refer to as the biogeochemical controls on the reactivity of these mineral organic complexes. And the example I'm going to use comes from work that we've done in collaboration. Really, this is a collaborative study with Oliver Chadwick, Peter Vitusik, Aaron Thompson, Mark Kramer, several folks in Hawaii looking at basalt weathering along an age sequence. And this has been done in the context of a lot of ecosystem scale studies that I'm not going to talk about. I'm just going to talk about some of the work that we've been involved in. And I'll start by talking about the long substrate age gradient, which is a famous chronosequence now in Hawaii that goes from the Big Island of Hawaii out to 4.1 million years on the island of Kauai. And what we see is that if we calculate the neutralization rate of protons derived, for example, from CO2 in rainwater or from respiration, there's a dramatic decrease in the rate of proton neutralization with increasing lava flow age as you proceed in this northwesterly direction. And you get to older lava flows, rates slow down dramatically. High initial rates are due to thermodynamically unstable primary silicates, glasses, olivines, pyroxenes that are high up in the Goldich series that we heard about earlier. Slow rates in the advanced stages result from the fact that there's precipitation of kinetically stable minerals, including silicate clays and oxides. And we can see the transformations along this long substrate age gradient. If we look, for example, at the fraction of metal, that could be silicon, aluminum, titanium, or iron, that's extractable from the soil in oxalate. And we see that there's a large fraction extractable in the surface horizons at early periods, and then a decrease with older soils. In the subsurface horizons, we see a significant increase to intermediate weathering stages and then a subsequent decrease. So the incipient mineral weathering products are short-range ordered aluminosilicates, including allophane and oxyhydroxides. And we can see this also in transmission electron micrographs of the soils, as shown here from a recent paper in GCA by Robert McCutta and others. We see that in early weathering stages, we see the accumulation of poorly crystalline weathering products in some of these TEM images and on the surfaces of more crystalline materials. And then by late weathering stages, we see the primarily formation of well-crystallized iron oxyhydroxides and aluminosilicate kaolinite in particular. And what's interesting, of course, and this has been known for some time, is that there is an accumulation coincident with this of high concentrations of organic carbon with these poorly crystalline products that form during intermediate stages in weathering in both the surface and the subsurface, up to very high concentrations of organic carbon in these basalt-derived soils. So overall, the weathering sequence in the transformation of these basalt soils is volcanic glasses and primary silicates weather to form metastable secondary or poorly crystalline mineral phases in intermediate stages. And then finally, we form what we term the climax mineralogy with kaolin group minerals and hydrous oxides of iron and aluminum. So what we're interested in is how this mineralogical transformation affects coupling processes between the minerals and the organic matter. So we're particularly interested in the processes of sequestration of organic carbon in these subsurface soils that have very high carbon concentrations. And some work being done by Mark Kramer at UC Santa Cruz shows nicely in C13 NMR spectra that there's a strong similarity in the carbon fingerprint, if you will, or functionality that's reflected in this NMR spectrum of the BW, the subsoil, soil carbon, relative to what we see in the O horizon, DOC. So this is dissolved organic carbon that's released from the O horizon, very similar in composition to what we see in the deep BW soil carbon. And both of these represent aromatic types of materials that have high carboxylic acid content as well. So look like lignin degradates or oxidized lignin monomers. What we also see is that the carboxyl carbonyl carbon content increases significantly and statistically significantly with short-range order mineral abundance, so with increasing allophane and amygdalite and ferrihydrite, these poorly crystalline minerals. We get an increasing fraction of that organic carbon that's this carboxyl carbonyl carbon. Okay, so what we've done in some of these column studies, we've taken these same soils across the LSAG and subjected them to column studies where we're simulating a rain input into a litter layer, looking at leachate DOM, then taking that DOM and passing it through a column of mineral soil, looking at the uptake of that leachate DOM in the mineral soil and the composition of the soil leachate that results. And what Mark has found in these experiments is that as you increase the poorly crystalline or short-range order mineral abundance, you have an increase in the affinity of organic matter, as shown here by these black symbols, an increase in the affinity of the organic matter for the soil, so there's a greater uptake. This parameter M, this adsorption coefficient, is a measure of affinity of the organic matter. It's essentially an uptake parameter in an adsorption isotherm. What we also see, so there's greater uptake with increasing short-range order mineral abundance in these mineral soils, and we also see a significant decrease in the specific UV absorption, which is a measure of the aromaticity of the carbon that's passing through the soil. So there's significant uptake of aromatic moieties, consistent with what we've seen before. Aromatic carboxyl-rich organics are being taken up onto the surfaces of short-range order minerals. And I want to point out that this high affinity at high short-range order mineral abundance is despite the fact that these soils already contain a really large concentration of organic carbon. So they're very rich in organic carbon, but they continue to suck up organic carbon as it passes through. So very effective sequesters despite being extremely rich in what one might expect sort of negatively charged organic matter present. In a related study we've done in collaboration with Robert McCutta and Georg Guggenberger at Hanover, University of Hanover, done some X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy of the carbon in these soils and looked at the carbon types that are most statistically associated with oxalate extractable iron, aluminum, and silicon, which are most prevalent in these soils. And what we see is that the correlations with oxalate extractable iron are distinctly different from what we see associated with oxalate extractable aluminum and silicon, which would be characteristic of allophane. And in the case of the oxalate extractable iron, we see a prevalence of aliphatic and amide carbon. So protein-rich carbon seems to associate with the oxalate extractable iron or the poorly crystalline iron. Whereas aromatic carboxyl-rich carbon, these lignin degradates, if you will, or these oxidized lignin fragments, seem to more specifically associate with the allophane or aluminosilicates. So there is this segregation of this dissolved organic matter onto different types of surfaces as it associates with the organic matter, with the organic-coated surfaces. So the other useful thing about X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy is that you can actually penetrate down and peel away the surface layers, sort of like peeling away the surfaces of an onion by sputtering argon on the surface and looking at how the surface changes as you do that. X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy is inherently a surface technique. It's looking at the sort of surface nanometers, if you will, of these particles. So it's not a bulk technique. It's really sensitive to the surface. And we can do some depth profiling of these mineral organic complexes. And if we plot as a function of site age here, so this is the chrono sequence, if we plot as a function of site age the surface enrichment factor of carbon and nitrogen, so this is the enrichment on the surface of a particle, here's organic matter coating an inorganic particle. If we have a discrete organic coating on an inorganic particle, then we have a high surface enrichment factor. If we don't have any apparent enrichment, then the surface enrichment factor should be equal to 1. And what's very interesting is that we see at the early and late stages of soil development, where we have more crystalline minerals present, we have surface enrichments of carbon and nitrogen. Okay, if we go, that's true both in the A and the B horizons. But for these intermediate age soils that have the highest concentrations of poorly crystalline minerals and also the highest concentrations by far of organic matter, we see no surface enrichment. In fact, it's more consistent with an equal distribution of carbon at the scale probed by XPS throughout these particles. And so what this tells us is that we have surface coatings of organic matter on crystalline phases in the young soils, surface coatings of organic matter on the crystalline phases in the oldest soils where we have goethite and kaolin. But where we have these high concentrations of poorly crystalline or nanoparticulate iron and aluminum oxides and a lot of high metal concentrations that could be forming complexes with the organics, the particles are more uniform in the distribution of these nanoparticles or monomeric metals and or coagulated with organic matter. And this is consistent with some work that Aaron Thompson did in his PhD thesis research, where he showed through transmission electron microscopy that there's this sort of cloudiness associated with organic, inorganic variability in electron density here. Some very small nanoparticles that are indeed exhibit some degree of crystallinity, as you can see from the lattice fringing here, but basically colloidal-sized particles that are coagulates of organic matter and nanoparticles. And so our current perspective on the nature of these mineral organic complexes along the LSAG is that we start with surface coatings of NOM on these crystalline minerals, transform to metastable nanoparticulate materials that are coagulated with organic matter. And then as the Ostwald ripening occurs, as these minerals form more well-crystalline phases, like the iron and aluminum oxides, we get coatings of organic matter on the surfaces again. Okay. And this can be thought of in this case as well, that these metastable intermediate phases are extremely rich in organic matter. That's where we have the most organic matter sequestered. So this tells us something about mechanisms of organic matter sequestration in these soils. These are also metastable, and they transform over time, over long pedogenic time scales, to more stable crystalline mineral phases. So there's this architecture effect that affects then surface reactivity of these mineral organic complexes. And we can see that in the context of surface charge behavior of these particles. If we look here at the slopes of variable surface charge curves, so this is a change in variable surface charge or net proton charge density with a unit change in pH. We can measure the slopes of those curves. So these are basically slopes of surface titrations. And we see that the slopes of the surface titrations are steepest for the intermediate age soils and less steep for the young and the older soils. Same is true for the subsurface horizons. So these intermediate age soils have very steep surface charge curves as well. We can then look at what the 0.0 net proton charge is on those curves that we determine from these titrations. And we can compare it to reference points of zero charge from model systems experiments, where, for example, we know natural organic matter has a very low 0.0 net charge. It's mostly negatively charged above pH 2. Amorphous silica and quartz, negatively charged above pH 2. Kaolinite has a 0.0 charge around 5. Aluminum or gibbsite, about 7. And allophane and goethite, closer to 8. So what's interesting is that the highest points of zero charge are in fact associated with soils that have the highest natural organic matter content. You know, these are totally swamped with NOM, and yet the points of zero charge are up around 7 or 8, which is more characteristic of what we would expect for allophane or iron oxyhydroxide. And so what we're seeing in this case is that down here at the younger and the older soils, the organic coatings are masking the inorganic material. But here in the intermediate age soils, inorganic coatings or metals that are complex with the organic matter is masking the surface chemistry, if you will, of the natural organic matter. Okay. If we just take one of these soils then and look at dissolution behavior as a function of surface charge, we see that if we increase the pH affect a decrease in the, or an increase in the negative value of surface charge, we get a large liberation of dissolved and colloidal organic matter. And this liberation of dissolved and colloidal organic matter over a relatively small pH range has a big influence on also the release of metals in association with that dissolved organic matter and strongly correlated. So how do we get such types of fluctuations in pH in soils? Well, they occur actually on relatively short time scales during redox fluctuations in redox active soils. And so as in a related study, as part of Aaron Thompson's PhD research, we studied a single age sequence of soils along what's called the Maui climate gradient, which is a precipitation gradient along a single 400,000-year-old lava flow that has a mean annual precipitation range that goes from 2 to 5 meters as you go up in elevation. And what these soils show is that as you go from low elevation or low rainfall and low elevation, it's low rainfall in relative terms for Hawaii. This is for Arizona, this is still pretty high, 2 meters of rainfall. Go from low elevation up to high elevation and high rainfall. You go from dominantly oxic environments through suboxic and anoxic. And as Aaron showed in some of his PhD research, there's also a dramatic decrease in the amount of iron that remains in the soil. You go from about 25% iron by mass to less than 1% iron by mass because of the enhanced reductive dissolution of iron that occurs along this rainfall gradient. And another thing that Aaron did in his PhD was he looked at Mossbauer spectroscopy, used Mossbauer spectroscopy to probe these soils across the rainfall gradient. And through fitting of the Mossbauer spectra in collaboration with Denny Rancourt at University of Ottawa, was able to delineate a range of different types of iron oxides in these soils and their change across this climate gradient. And what we see here is that even though we get into dominantly reducing conditions at the high rainfall sites, it's predominantly iron or ferric oxyhydroxide. So iron is present as an oxidized form of iron. And that's true both in the surface and subsurface fractions. that there is a change as you go across the gradient. There's two different temperature values here where the Mohs barre spectroscopy data were collected. Low temperature, 4.2 K, and room temperature, 295 K. And you see that the magnetic ordering temperature of the iron oxides, there's an increase in the more poorly crystalline or short-range ordered iron oxides as you go across the increasing rainfall gradient at the expense of the more well-crystalline oxides. There's also an increase in organic or silicate-bound iron, which we attribute largely to organic bound iron, but there could be a component of silicate bound iron as well, and a very small proportion of ferrous iron in these samples, despite the fact that these are anoxic soils at high rainfall. But they do show up at higher rainfall. Ferrous iron does show up at high rainfall, as shown here. But there is then, as you increase rainfall, there's a decrease in the crystal size or the crystallinity of these oxides with increasing rainfall. If we then focus on one specific sample and do some laboratory experiments, one of the things that Aaron did for his thesis was to simulate in the laboratory the redox fluctuations associated with rainfall and reaeration events that could be associated with these types of soils at relatively high rainfall. And we know that that will tend to fluctuate soils in and out of supersaturation and undersaturation with respect to iron oxides, like ferrihydrite. So he took a soil from the A horizon of that soil that I showed earlier and built a really nice replicated redox reactor setup where he could have three replicated reactors looking at the same sample as a function of time and could vary the oxidation state through varying the head space gas chemistry, including oxygen, fluctuating between oxygen and nitrogen, increasing oxygen concentrations in the headspace during the oxidation cycles. And what he saw was during reducing cycles, shown in gray, a decrease in the PE, as you would expect. The microorganisms are consuming oxidant, reducing PE. During the oxidizing cycles, there's an increase in PE. During the reducing cycles, a resurgence of a decrease in PE, et cetera. And these fluctuations occur across the time frame of the experiment. Each one of these half cycles are 7 days. And during the reducing cycles, we were seeing a significant increase in the iron 2 concentration in aqueous solution and a decrease during the oxidizing cycles. And indeed, these systems were fluctuating between undersaturation and supersaturation with respect to ferrihydrite. So during the reducing cycles, there's a lot of iron in solution, but your system is still undersaturated with respect to ferrihydrite. You reintroduce oxygen, and you precipitate ferrihydrite. And this happens on relatively short, week-long timescales. And what was interesting, one thing that was observed was a fluctuation in the DOC concentration in the suspensions. During the reducing cycles, DOC was released to solution. During the oxidizing cycles, DOC was sequestered or flocculated out of solution due to the precipitation and coagulation of the colloids in the suspension. So these redox fluctuations not only strongly affect iron, but also affect release and sequestration of dissolved organic carbon. We also saw, very interestingly, and this relates to this point about changing the bulk chemistry of the solids over relatively short time scales, we saw a significant increase in the crystallinity or the long-range order of the iron oxyhydroxides in this system over time. That was observed both from wet chemical extractions. HCl extraction of iron went down over time. Oxalate extraction of iron went down over time. And it was also verified through Mohs barre fits to the solid phase chemistry at the beginning and end of the experiment that indicated an increase in the long-range crystal order of the iron oxides in this soil, which occurred over a period of, in this case, 56 days. So relatively short time scales had a significant and measurable effect on the mineral crystallinity in these systems. These redox fluctuations also influence significantly the aggregation and dispersion of colloids in the system, as indicated here by colloidal titanium, which isn't subjected to a redox transformation. But we related that directly to a pH increase that occurs during the reducing cycles. You go from pH about 3.6 up to pH about 5.5. And that pH increase that occurs because of reduction of iron in the system is sufficient to disperse colloids and release them into mobile form, to make them more mobile in the environment. Typically, this was observed also not just for titanium, but for a bunch of elements that we typically consider to be quote-unquote immobile elements, for example, in pedogenic studies, including zirconium, niobium, lanthanum, and uranium. So there was a significant mobilization just due to redox cycling in these systems. So to conclude, natural age and climate gradients are useful to understanding the formation, architecture, and reactivity of mineral organic complexes. The architecture that results from pedogenesis is a function of pedogenic stage and weathering environment. The reactivity of the mineral organic interface is a direct function of surface structure. And this is not necessarily consistent with bulk chemistry. As we can see, very organic-rich soils have a surface chemistry that looks a lot more like iron and aluminum oxides, which was surprising to us. Mineral organic complexes are labile, and the microbial response to environmental perturbations, such as redox state, can rapidly be translated not only into a change in the surface chemistry of these particles, but also in their bulk compositions, as reflected, for example, in the increased crystallinity of the iron oxide that occurred over a relatively short time scale in those experiments. So I want to acknowledge the fact that this has really been a collaborative project from the start, which was some time ago now. A lot of the work I talked about today was the PhD thesis research of Aaron Thompson, who's now at the University of Georgia. This has always been a collaboration with Oliver Chadwick and Peter Vitusek, who are sort of the guiding lights on the Hawaii Ecosystems Project. Some of the data I showed today was deriving from some studies in collaboration with Mark Kramer at UC Santa Cruz, and some of the XPS data were collected in collaboration with McCutta and Guggenberger at Hanover, and support from National Science Foundation and USDA.
Plenty of time for questions for John.
Yes.
I might have missed it, but it is a little bit surprising that you mentioned that the high organic matter actually does not convey signature on surface charge. Is that kind of, and I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around that. How does it work? How does the fact that so much organic matter still have such an iron and a little bit of signature on the charge?
So what we think is the reason for that is that in these intermediate age soils, these are very active weathering systems. We have very high concentrations of aluminum and iron and silicon in solution in the pore waters of those intermediate age soils. So what that does is it creates an environment that promotes the precipitation of poorly crystalline or metastable types of minerals that can be nanoparticles or nanocolloidal. So these nanoparticles that we don't see really in X-ray diffraction data, but we do see when we look very closely with high resolution TEM, can actually precipitate on the surfaces of the organic matter. And also on the surfaces of the organic matter, we think we have a pretty strong proliferation of monomeric metal species. So a lot of these carboxyl groups that are there, we know they're there from the NMR data and IR data. We think that those carboxyl groups are also complexed with iron and aluminum, and so that the charge they exhibit is really the charge that's associated with a carboxyl group, but an iron and aluminum atom, or ion, at that surface that undergoes hydrolysis and has hydrolysis behavior that's more like goethite or gibbsite than it is like organic matter. So this organic stuff, it's by mass, it's all there, but the surface is coated with a more weakly based, a more weakly acidic type of chemistry. And we see that consistently across the data sets, so we feel pretty comfortable that that's the case. Yeah?
You have this time sequence. Are these all sampled in the same kind of biotopes, the same kind of plants?
So that's an excellent question, and I didn't... Yeah. One of the great things about this chronosequence or time sequence is that it's subjected to the same climate, and that climate's been relatively constant over pedogenic timescales. It's been shown by some of Oliver Chadwick's previous work, and that the biota of Hawaii is remarkably impoverished. And so there's a very relatively narrow ecosystem diversity in Hawaii, and all of the sites that we've looked at are dominated by the same species of tree, Metrosideros parlimorpha, which is...
So it's under trees?
It's all forest. It's tropical rainforest. Sorry, I should have mentioned that.
That's the thing, because you mentioned very briefly in the beginning that there was some smectite present in the initial stages, but you studied some time ago.
Yeah.
Find smectite under prairies, but not very much.
Yeah, so we were surprised by the presence of 2-to-1 layer silicates.
Yeah.
And I was interested in actually Bob's slide that showed that you can get biotite formation in basalts, because this has been sort of a little controversial. But we see definitely formation of vermiculite and smectite from the basalts, even though there's no biotite present. There's no biotite present in the basalt that we can detect. And so what we think that may be coming from, there's been some previous studies. Lou Derry and Oliver Chadwick showed that there were significant dust inputs that contained quartz and also mica to Hawaii. So we think that the smectite may be coming from the weathering of the dust imported mica. But it's possible that it's generated there. The solutions are definitely supersaturated with respect to smectite. They could form.
Soil horizon under the plants in a study that got published from China, the initial stages you form a little bit of these 2-to-1 silicates. When the plants can control sufficiently and bring up silicate to maintain a high silicate minerals, and then it's damped up at a high
rainfall. Yeah. We see it too. I mean, we have beautiful X-ray diffraction data that shows the emergence in the intermediate stages of this 2-to-1, you know, this 1.4 nanometer peak, and then it just disappears after 400,000 years in the LSAG. It's gone, and it's all kaolinite, basically. Yes?
Based on your results, so a large variability in Reynolds condition should be considered as a destabilization mechanism for organic matter. I would not necessarily found organic matter associated with minerals showing low concentrations of 14C. Is it one?
Low concentration of 14C?
Yeah, when I measure maybe a fraction of one association derived from soils with changing redox conditions, that means I wouldn't find stable organic matter in terms of.
No, actually, it turns out that those intermediate age soils, for example, have very high stable organic matter concentrations. So they're very old in terms of 14C composition. But they have extremely high pool sizes as well. And I think that the redox fluctuations, that there's no question that we can destabilize some of this mineral, you know, we would characterize it presumably as mineral-associated carbon, but it disperses. In this case, though, it's not the traditional way we think about mineral-associated carbon, where we have a mineral surface and a little coating of organic matter. It's more like there are mineral nanoparticles associated with aggregated organic matter in sort of these supramolecular structures of organic matter, right, that are coagulated then with some of these nanoparticles and metals. And so in that case, we are dispersing those, and they are mobilized, but they may not go very far in a natural soil system. In a laboratory system, we find that they mobilize, they go into the supernatant solution. The question of where they go in the actual soil profile, maybe they don't travel very far down into the subsoil where there's lower carbon, and then they become less susceptible to further disturbance in redox cycles later. It's possible. We haven't looked at that sort of profile horizonation. But it is old carbon that's being dispersed. Yeah? So the LSAG basically falls sort of right on that zone that we expect would be undergoing fluctuations between oxidizing and reducing conditions for iron 3. And as a result, some of the data, several of the data sources indicate that. So yeah, along the LSAG, we think we're seeing these redox cycles
He also has the test side where the followers talk about the threshold of time.
That's actually a different, yeah, that's on what's called the Kohala gradient, primarily. And that's a different climate gradient, but very similar, although younger in age, than the Maui climate gradient. So the Maui climate gradient is 400,000 years old. The Kohala gradient is about 150,000 years old. They're actually very similar in many respects in terms of their mineralogy. There's not a huge difference between 150 and 400,000 years in terms of the transformations.
Right. Well, let's thank John again.